Listen to the land, it has a story for you, about people and their dreams and how they made them come true. Listen to the land, listen to the land.
Without question, there were two things the covered wagon pioneers looked forward to seeing: a herd of buffalo and a real live Indian. By the time the wagon trains had reached the Platte Valley, they'd probably seen their first buffalo, and the immense herds of shaggy beasts must have impressed them. But they had mixed feelings about the Indians they saw. The pitiful, begging Indians that hung around the frontier settlements revolted them. And yet, along the trail, they caught glimpses of proud Sioux and Cheyenne warriors. These Indians thrilled and frightened them. The covered wagon pioneers distrusted the Indians. They looked down on the savages, but more often they feared them. While it's impossible to know precisely what the Indians thought about the white pioneers, we can assume that they resented the wagon trains which split and scattered the buffalo herds and which drove most of the game from the Platte Valley, which had been for years the Indians' favorite hunting grounds. The Indians did not put up any organized resistance to the wagon trains. Oh, occasionally a band would raid small, poorly defended parties, but if the whites were careful, the Indians could do little but beg and steal. Everyone knew, white man and red man alike, that this uneasy peace could not last. Sooner or later, there would be trouble. The federal government had responsibility for dealing with the prairie tribes. Two approaches were employed by the men who made Indian policy. First, military force to keep the Indians in check, and second, negotiations to persuade the Indians to leave the white men alone. For a few years, the combined military policy and treaties worked. But in 1854, a band of Indians camped just east of Fort Laramie made off with a cow from a wagon train. A party of soldiers led by Lieutenant John Grattan was sent to recover the cow, and the entire company was wiped out by the Indians. The grave, which contains the bodies of the 27 men killed in the Grattan massacre, can be seen at the Fort McPherson Cemetery south of Maxwell. Be sure you visit this place. Now, to punish the Indians for the massacre, an army of about 1,000 men, the largest ever sent to the West, came up the trail. Under General Harney, they caught several bands of Indians north of Ash Hollow on the North Platte River and severely mauled them. The army then crossed the Dakota Plains, giving the Indians ruthless warning that they'd better behave themselves. And for the next few years, the Indians kept a sullen peace. But then the Civil War began, and the Western Plains burst into flames. Why did the Indian Wars break out? For one thing, the coming of the Civil War drastically reduced the number of soldiers available for duty along the frontier. Many men and officers volunteered for the Confederate armies, and the loyal troops were pulled out for duty in the East. But most important, the westward movement did not slacken during the war. Thousands of pioneers continued to use the trails, and the Indians decided the time had come to strike. Indian fighting was hard, discouraging work. The Indians knew and understood the land, and they took advantage of it. Their ponies were accustomed to the plains, and Indian horses could easily outrange the cavalry horses. Even when traveling with women and children in baggage, Indians had little difficulty escaping from the soldiers. But most frustrating of all, the Indians refused to fight according to white men's rules. You can count on the fingers of one hand the number of times U.S. cavalry were able to mount a charge of the kind you see on TV. The Indians seldom risked a front fight. No, the Indians fought by ambush and skirmish, the most frightening kind of warfare for white men. Soldiers complained that the Indians never stood and fought like men. You thought you had a band cornered and they'd slip away to attack at some unprotected settlement or ambush an unsuspecting detachment of troops. It was guerrilla warfare, the type of war our generation of American fighting men have experienced in Vietnam. The enemy was nowhere, and yet he was everywhere. Indians vanished into the prairies and the sandhills, and soldiers wore themselves and their horses out, trying to track them down. It would have taken thousands of soldiers to control the plains, and yet during the Indian Wars, the army never numbered more than a few dozen regiments of poorly trained and poorly equipped men. During the Civil War, the shortage of men was especially bad, and desperate Northern officials recruited Confederate prisoners from Northern prison camps and sent them west to fight Indians. Galvanized Yankees, they were called. And some of the troopers were immigrants who'd recently arrived in the country. Many of them were Irishmen who found soldiering tough and dirty work.
3 years ago this very day, I went to Governor's Isle to stand for Nince the Cannon in military style. 13 American dollars each month we'd surely get to carry a gun and bayonet in military step. There's Sergeant John McCafferty and Corporal Donahue. They make us march up to the crack in gallant Company Q. The drums they roll upon my soul, and that's the way we go. 40 miles a day and beans and hay in the regular army, oh. There's corns upon me feet, me boys, and bunions on me toes, and lugging a gun in the red hot sun puts freckles on me nose. And if you want a furlough, to the captain you do go. He says go to bed and wait till you're dead in the regular army, oh. There's Sergeant John McCafferty and Corporal Donahue. They make us march up to the crack in gallant Company Q. The drums they roll upon my soul, and that's the way we go. 40 miles a day on beans and hay in the regular army, oh.
Unable to defeat the Indians in a set battle, Army leaders adopted other tactics, again a tactic which our generation knows something about. They decided to wage total war, that is, to strike and destroy the Indian villages, make it impossible for Indian men, women, and children to live in any kind of security. Army officers regarded the buffalo hunters as an important part of this program, for the destruction of the buffalo herds necessarily meant tremendous suffering and eventually starvation for the Indians. So the Indians could not be defeated in battle. Well, maybe they could be brought to their knees by starvation. This kind of cruel war, waged as much against women and children as against the warriors, was not particularly popular in this country. To the frontiersman, the only good Indian was a dead Indian, but not all Americans agreed. Lengthy debates rang through the halls of Congress, where men criticized the operations conducted by the Army. Many insisted that a better policy would be to treat the Indians justly. It would be easier and cheaper, they argued, to civilize them rather than to fight them. But so long as the Indians continued to attack wagon trains and frontier settlements, the advocates of a policy of peace at any price had very few listeners. The Army extended its operations. In 1863, troops built Fort McPherson near the forks of the Platte River. A few years later, Fort Sidney was built to protect the crews of men building the Union Pacific Railroad. Fort McPherson was a very important post because its troops guarded the section of the trail which the Indians frequently harassed. Expeditions launched from Fort McPherson went south to clear out the Indians, and with these troops went Buffalo Bill Cody. Make no mistake, Cody was one of the great scouts of the West. The Army recognized his value, and many officers commended him for his skill and bravery. And to Fort McPherson came many important people who wanted to see the Wild, Wild West. In 1872, the Grand Duke Alexis of Russia arrived at the fort to take part in the most famous buffalo hunt ever staged on the Western Plains. And of course, Buffalo Bill was there to show the Duke how to bring down the mighty monarchs of the plains. These frontier army posts perform many important functions. In addition to providing protection against the Indians, they gave an economic boost to nearby settlements. Soldiers and horses needed supplies, which local contractors provided. The construction of Fort Hartsiff on the Loup River in north-central Nebraska in 1874 provided employment for farmers whose crops had been destroyed by the grasshoppers. And the troops were the only agents of law and order along the frontier, and much time was spent searching for horse thieves and other criminals who sought sanctuary in the prairie wilderness. In time, the army posts took on a more civilized atmosphere. Houses were built for the families of the men, schools were opened for the children, and a lively social life developed. But there was still the hard work of soldiering to be done, and when the troops marched out of the fort, we can imagine that the women and children lined the parade ground, listening sadly to the band play this song.
I'm lonesome since I crossed the hill and left that happy valley. Such heavy thoughts my heart do fill since parting with my Sally. I seek no more the fine and gay, for each does but remind me how swift the hours did pass away with the girl I left behind me.
As you cross the western plains where Indian wars scarred the land for generations, a question will come to mind. How real was the Indian danger? Were the whites justified in waging ruthless war against the prairie tribes? Today, of course, we're likely to feel that the white people overreacted, to use a modern term, to the problem of the Indian. But let's not forget how the frontiersmen felt. Remember one homesteader's wife who planned what she would do with her children if Indians attacked the house? She trained her four children to run with her to the nearby creek and to stand waiting their turn for her to drown them one by one. Such was the frontier atmosphere, an incredible, constant fear. Small wonder that the settlers demanded that the Indian threat be erased, and the army undertook the thankless task of crushing the Indians. Eventually, the construction of railroads, the annihilation of the buffalo, and the constant increase in white settlers sealed the fate of the Indians. It was a tragic page in our history. The most tragic thing is that it's difficult to see how it could have been done any differently.
I'm lonesome since I crossed the hill and left that happy valley. Such heavy thoughts my heart do fill since parting with my Sally. I seek no more the fine and gay, for each does but remind me how swift the hours did pass away with the girl I left behind me. Listen to the land, it has a story for you about people and their dreams and how they made them come true. Listen to the land, listen to the land.
The more you learn to listen to the land, the more you come to realize that history is not a series of disconnected, unrelated incidents. Things which happen in one place influence the way things happen elsewhere. It's like a stone you throw into a pool of water. The stone hits only one spot, but the ripples spread over the entire surface. I can illustrate this best by the story of the Western cattle industry. You remember that the first men who saw the Great Plains were not impressed with what they saw. They didn't think men or animals would ever live on the barren land. But then the wagon train started across the prairie trails, and quite accidentally, the bullwhackers and the emigrants found that animals could stay alive in the plains. The winters weren't as bad as originally thought, and the short brown grass proved to be more than adequate as feed for cattle and horses. So the first pebble had plunked into the puddle. The second splash occurred in Texas, where for years cattle ranchers had been searching for profitable markets. The situation was critical after the Civil War. The Texans had to find markets for their cattle. Then, the third pebble hits the water. Railroads begin to reach out across the northern plains. Towns appear along the gleaming rails, and soon cattle buyers turn up. Word spreads to Texas that if the cattlemen can drive their critters north to the railroad, men will be there to buy them, and at a handsome profit to the cattlemen. The buyers, in turn, sell the Texas cattle to meat packers, to Iowa and Illinois farmers, to government agents responsible for feeding the reservation Indians, and to men who wanted to start ranches on the northern plains. So now the ripples have spread over the plains. All of the events fit together. The Texas cattlemen gather their longhorn steers and headed north.
As I was a-walking one morning for pleasure, spied a young cowboy a-jogging along. His hat was throwed back, his spurs were a-jingling, and as he approached, he was singing this song. Whoop-de-tie-yi-yo, get along, little dogies. Your misfortune and none of my own. Whoop-de-tie-yi-yo, get along, little dogies. You know that Wyoming will be your new home. You're gonna make beefsteak for Uncle Sam's Indians. It's beef, heap beef, I hear them call. Roll on, roll on, roll on, you little dogies. You're gonna be beefsteak long before fall. Whoop-de-tie-yi-yo, get along, little dogies. It's your misfortune and none of my own. Whoop-de-tie-yi-yo, get along, little dogies. You know that Wyoming will be your new home. You was born and raised below the Nueces, where the mesquite and cactus and chaparral grow. So fill yourselves up with grass in Nebraska and roll your tails for old Idaho. Whoop-de-tie-yi-yo, get along, little dogies. It's your misfortune and none of my own. Whoop-de-tie-yi-yo, get along, little dogies. Know that Wyoming will be your new home. Mm-hmm.
The trails which led from southern Texas to the railroads in Kansas and Nebraska went by many names. There was the Sedalia Trail, the Goodnight Trail, the Western Trail. But best known was the Chisholm Trail.
Now come along, boys, and listen to my tale. I'll tell you a story of the old Chisholm Trail. Tum-a-tie-yi, yippee-yippee-yay, yippee-yay. Tum-a-tie-yi, yippee-yippee-yay. With my feet in the stirrups and my hand on the horn, the best darn cowboy that ever was born. Tum-a-tie-yi, yippee-yippee-yay, yippee-yay. Tum-a-tie-yi, yippee-yippee-yay. With a $10 horse and a $40 saddle, I'm gonna punch some Texas cattle. Tum-a-tie-yi, yippee-yippee-yay, yippee-yay. Tum-a-tie-yi, yippee-yippee-yay.
There were usually about 2,500 head of cattle in a trail herd. Depending upon delays and setbacks, the herd spent from 3 to 5 months on the trail. The drovers hoped to make up to 20 miles a day, but no one with any sense tried to make hard and fast prediction. To handle 2,500 longhorns, there were, as a rule, 15 cowboys. The boss, the wrangler who cared for the horse herd, the cook and his helper, and the rest were the hands of the cowboys. The star of the trail drive, in my opinion, was the Texas Longhorn, an animal which was admirably suited for the trail. They were strong, long-legged, and able to endure great hardships. While their meat left something to be desired, this was not important. What mattered was that the Longhorn could cover 2,000 miles of dusty trail. Old-timers said that the whole success of the drive was determined during the first few days in the trail. The trick was to get the cattle moving along the trail without pressing them too hard. Always let the cattle think you're letting them do what they want to do. That was the advice of the experienced trail hands. So the cowboys rode the edge of the herd, gently, firmly urging the critters north. It was hard work, and the cowboy knew he could not have done it without a horse with real cow sense. There's no way we can exaggerate the importance of the horse to the trail hands. After all, a man on foot wasn't much good on a drive. Each cowboy was allotted a number of horses, sometimes as many as 10, and the good hands took real pains to keep their horses in shape. None of the wild galloping across the plain just for the fun of it, like you see on TV. Real cowboys would never risk breaking down their horses in that way. There were enough dangers involved in handling the required chores without inviting trouble. Naturally, the cowboys developed a strong attachment for their favorite horses, and very often they sang about the animals which shared their life on the trail.
We're alone, Donegal, in the rain and hail, driving them doggies down the trail. It's rain or shine, sleet or snow, Me and my Donny gal are on the go. It's rain or shine, sleet or snow. Me and my Donny gal are bound to go. A cowboy's life is a weary thing, for it's rope and brand and ride and sing. We'll ride the range from sun to sun, for a cowboy's work is never done. He's up and gone at the break of day, driving doggies on their way.
The drive north was no easy jaunt. Take a look at a map of the Great Plains and you'll see why. Almost all of the rivers on the plains run from west to east. The herds came to these rivers in spring and early summer, just when they were running at flood tide. Without question, the cowboys ran great risks when they took the longhorns across one of these swollen rivers. Then, between the rivers, they ran into stretches of dry drives, that is, miles and miles where there was no water at all for either the men or the animals. But the greatest problem, as we all know, were the stampedes. Cattle on the trail were quite unpredictable. Any little thing could set off a wild stampede. At night, while the herd was bedded down along the trail, cowboys rode around the animals, softly singing or whistling, in order to cover unexpected noises. But sometimes there was nothing the men could do, and in a split second, a herd would be up and running. Then it was up to the trail hands to turn the cattle, to get them milling in a huge circle to prevent them from scattering all over the prairie. Running with a stampeding herd was dangerous work. Countless cowboys were crushed under the hooves of the cattle when their horses stumbled and fell. And just about every cowboy had a friend who died in this way.
A group of jolly cowboys discussing plans at ease. Says one, "I'll tell you something, boys, if you will listen, please. I am an old cowpuncher, and here I'm dressed in rags. I used to be a tough one and go on great big jags. But I have got a home, boys, a good one you all know, although I haven't seen it since long, long ago. I'm going back to Dixie once more to see them all. I'm gonna see my mother when the work's all done this fall." While riding in the darkness, so loudly did he shout, trying his best to head them and turn the herd about. His saddle horse did stumble, and on him it did fall. Now he won't see his mother when the work's all done this fall. Poor Charlie was buried at sunrise, no tombstone at his head, nothing but a little board, and this is what it said: Charlie died at daybreak, he died from a fall, and he'll not see his mother when the work's all done this fall.
The hardships and dangers of trail life slipped from the minds of the cowboys as the herds approached the cow towns, places like Abilene and Dodge City, Kansas, and Ogallala, Nebraska. Once in town, the men had a chance to buy some new clothes. Months on the trail had made tatters of what they owned. But more important, it meant a chance to visit the Crystal Palace Saloon, where the cowboys rest. The boredom and anxieties of the trail were forgotten as the hands had a good time. No wonder Ogallala was known as the Gomorrah of the Plains, because when the trail hands rode in, it became a mighty exciting place. While TV and movies exaggerate the violence which occurred in the streets of the cowtown, enough went on to keep life from getting dull. No wonder the cowboys anxiously pushed the critters toward the railroad. Once the cows were in the corral by the tracks, the cowboys were ready for town.
Oh, we're up in the morning, ere breaking of day. The chuck wagon's busy, the flapjacks in play. The herd is astir over hillside and vale, with the night riders rounding them into the trail. Oh, come take up your cinches, come shake out your reins, come wake your old bronco, break for the plains. Come rouse out your steers from the long chaparral, for the outfit is off to the railroad corral. So flap up your holster, snap on your belt, and strap up your saddle whose lap you have felt. Goodbye to the steers from the long chaparral, for there's a town that's a trunk by the railroad corral.
Men who remember the days of the Texas trail herds have said that at times during the summer, the entire Platte Valley east and west of Ogallala was filled with herds of Texas longhorns grazing along the river, waiting to be shipped east or moved on farther north. Thousands of longhorn cattle as far as the eye could see. What a sight that must have been. And always at hand, the Texas trail hand. He'd done his job. There was nothing really glamorous about what he had done. It was just plain, hard, ugly work. His day stretched from dusk and into the night. And many, many times, he must have thought about the comrades he had left along the trail.
Bury me not on the lone prairie. These words came low and mournfully from the pallid lips of a youth who lay on his dying bed. At the break of day, I've always wished to be laid when I die in a little church on a green hillside by my father's grave.